Hey, welcome back everyone to the channel. Tonight's terrifying story is about this 911 operator and his small town, what he witnesses off the clock, and everything that happens to him, his family, and the people that he loves will shock you. Now let's get spooky. If you're new to the channel, subscribe, click on that bell, and smash that thumbs up and tell a friend. "911, what is your emergency?" I said, answering on the first ring. It had been a slow day up to that point, but that was all about to change in a moment. "I saw something bad," a hysterical female voice cried on the other end of the line. "My neighbor, she's outside, and she's bleeding."
"Bleeding from where?" I said.
"Everywhere," she screamed.
I tried to get her address, but she was so hysterical that she kept yelling for help. Eventually, she calmed down enough to give me her street. I heard new voices in the background, all shrieking. "We have a unit on the way," I said. "Just stay on the line with me. It's going to be okay."
"No,"
she whispered, barely audible over the screaming in the background.
"It isn't."
A few minutes later, I was in the break room getting a coffee, trying to stop my hands from shaking. I was hyperventilating, full of an incomprehensible terror and anxiety that I never felt on this job before. Before the call had cut out, it sounded like a street full of rabid people just surrounding the caller's house. Then the radio came on from the police unit that had been first to arrive at the scene. "Dispatch, you there? This is Shay." I heard the voice of Trooper Shay crackling. I immediately picked up on the backup unit we kept in the break room.
"This is Dispatch," I said. "What's going on?"
"I came down from Kansas Street from Union Road, and it's totally empty, except for a few bloodstains."
"Were you able to get the house number of the caller?" he asked.
"Negative on that," I said. "Do you see any broken glass or smashed down doors? It sounded like pure hell on the other end of the call." She claimed she was being attacked by her neighbors. Trooper Shay consulted with his partner on the street for a moment before responding.
"We just heard screaming and glass shattering. It sounds like it came from number 67 on Kansas Street. Send backup."
I ran back to the main room. We had a new system that could live stream 911 calls directly to the cars of police in the area, as well as live stream audio from the car back to dispatch. I turned it on, entering the number of Trooper Shay's patrol car and listened intently.
"Come out with your hands up,"
I heard Shay's partner yell. Shay gasped.
"Oh God, she needs medical attention," he said. "She's got blood coming out of her eyes, her ears, her nose, and vomiting blood. What do you think she has?"
"Ma'am, stop right there," Trooper Shay yelled. "Do not come closer." Then I heard a rash of swearing and yelling, followed by a gunshot. I dropped my coffee cup on the floor, hearing it shatter and spread burning hot liquid across my shoes. But I was too engrossed and horrified by what I was hearing that I barely noticed.
"Oh God, she bit me," Shay's partner said. "She bit my frickin' thumb off."
I heard another series of gunshots and then the slamming of car doors.
"Go, go, go,"
one of them said, and I heard the squealing of tires.
"Oh, F, what is that?"
Shay said. Then his voice came in over the radio. "Dispatch, this is Shay. We have a major obstruction blocking the intersection of Kansas and Maine. It looks like... I know this is going to sound batshit insane, but it looks like a pile of bodies. Literally hundreds of them. Stacked up on top of each other like firewood. Maybe they're just mannequins. I don't know. But most of them look like they're bleeding. We need backup immediately, and emergency medical service as well." Trooper Ingram lost a finger when we got surrounded by a dozen drugged up or sick lunatics back there. One of them bit me on the damn calf through my uniform, but I don't think it will require medical attention. They were biting, scratching, and hissing like snakes. There's something wrong here, I'm telling you. This is dispatch, I said, and backup is on the way. I want to tell him to get the hell out of there. Drive the other way, but I wasn't a cop. I had no authority to do any such thing. They would likely think it was their primary duty to secure and protect the scene until the other police arrived. My shift was about to end in a few minutes when this insanity began, and my replacement walked in just as I hung up the radio. She looked at me, one eyebrow raised. "You're not going to believe this," I told her, and briefed her on everything that was happening. Her mouth opened more and more as I recounted the story. Her eyes widened in horror. And by the end, I still hadn't heard from Trooper Shea or his backup. I was having anxiety and just wanted to get out of there. My family lived nearby, and if there was some sort of crime spree or pandemic happening, I wanted to be home to protect them. My son was only 7 years old, and I knew he could not protect himself in such an apocalyptic calamity as was occurring in our little town. As she sat down in the dispatcher's chair, another 911 call came in, and I took the opportunity to get my stuff and head out of there. I had only a 5-minute drive back home. My knuckles were white as I sped down the residential streets at 30 miles over the speed limit. Traffic was sparse, and I saw nothing out of place. Until I turned onto my street, that is. My neighbor was an elderly man whose 60-year-old granddaughter lived with him. Both of them were standing in the middle of the road, staring up at the sun, their mouths open. I saw long knives in each of their right hands. I slammed on the brakes a few feet away from them, but they didn't stir. I tried honking my horn, but they just kept staring up at the sky without any awareness. As I looked down from their faces, I realized they were both viciously sawing at their bodies, opening up shallow slice after shallow slice. A waterfall of blood began to run down their skin, soaking into the pavement. I nearly threw up in disgust. I backed up, driving on my neighbor's lawn to get around them, putting down my window to yell as I passed by. "What the hell are you doing, Mr. James?" I screamed at him. "Stop this now!" I wondered whether I should jump out and try to stop them, but with their current mental states, I felt they might be just as liable to stab me as not if I got out. Suddenly, Mr. James' eyes came down, focusing directly on mine, and the knives stopped moving. The little girl grinned at me, waving the blood-soaked butcher knife back and forth, sending droplets of crimson sprayed on my car and her dress. She's telling me to cut myself, to let the viruses in," Mr. James said, and his granddaughter stared straight ahead like a doll. It was as if they felt no pain. I saw the blood-covered tendons and muscles of their legs, stomachs, and chests as they stood there, slicing deeper and faster, wavering like trees in the hurricane. Mr. James fell to the ground, blood continuously pouring out of him, and his granddaughter pointed behind me, nearly tripping. Her head lolling from side to side as her lips started to turn a light blue, probably from the constant blood loss and impending physical collapse.
"She's here for you too," she said. "She wants to play with you. She wants you to open up and let the viruses slide in. They look for the soft, warm spots. They're so cold. Open it up and let them in, and you'll never be sad again."
Slowly, I turned, seeing the corpse of a girl standing there next to a tree in my neighbor's backyard. Her skin was bleached white, and her mouth was sewn shut, ugly black stitches marring her cyanotic purplish lips. Her stringy black hair hung down past her shoulders, framing her face as she stared directly at me. Her eyes were milky white, like cataracts, and I saw countless maggots wriggling throughout her body, eating away at the skin of her arms and legs. "Do you feel the wetness of their tongues? The dead ones just want in." Her voice rang out in my head, distorting and demonic and low. Her lips never moved, and her eyes never moved. The corpse girl just continued to stare in my direction. I felt hypnotized, sitting there in my car. Then I felt them, cold tongues that drew across my back and chest. The car filled with the smell of sulfur and decay. Then my vision began to turn black, as her voice took over my mind and I fell into a dreamless sleep. "Dad?" I felt little hands pushing on my chest. I opened one eye groggily, forgetting where I was for a few moments. Then I shot up in my seat, adrenaline coursing through my body as I looked around for the corpse girl. "She's gone, Dad. I got rid of her, for now." I looked down at him, amazed. "Anthony?" I whispered, looking at him. My head throbbed painfully. "How did you get rid of that thing?" I asked. He shrugged. "I could do weird stuff sometimes," he said, "like turning my birthday party last year." I remembered the birthday party clearly. We had a clown who juggled and cartwheeled and did all sorts of tricks for my son and his friends. My son said he could juggle too, and he wanted to show the clown. He had run into the house, grabbed a few of our knives, and started throwing them up in the air. They seemed to slow down as they rose, floating slowly over his head. They fell as if through water, and Anthony grabbed them easily and threw them back up into the air. "How is he doing that?" the clown had asked me, breaking character. I had no idea and simply stood there, speechless. Then I yelled his name, and the knives all came clattering to the lawn. "She was strong. I felt her mind. It was cold like an icicle going into my head, but I kept her back by building a wall." He pointed to the backyard where the corpse of the girl had stood. "And I kept her there, Dad." I realized he was not talking about a physical wall, but some sort of mental wall that he had made in his mind. I nodded. "She was trying to take you. I could feel the words that came out of her head and into yours. I heard everything she was saying, and she was showing me things. Really bad, really scary things from where she comes from. She told me that in her home, all the roads are paved with bones of kids like myself, and that all the girls like her have their mouths sewn shut so that they never have to rely on using their mouths to speak. They use their brains somehow. The whole place is run by an insane god who lies by this silver stream. She shows me the god, and I felt it looking at me. It was like insects were looking at me, like insects with huge brains and big, dark, scary eyes." He shuddered. "What kind of god is that, Dad?" "A god I never want to meet, that's for sure," I said, tousling his hair, trying to get him to smile. "The god that we believe in is eternal love and light. Whatever that little girl worships, it isn't God." Anthony's eyes continued to blankly look ahead as he recalled what the eldritch girl had shown him. Then they looked up at me sharply. "I don't understand the stuff about viruses that she kept saying. What's going on? Are we going to be sick?" he asked, looking so little and helpless in his tiny windbreaker and jeans. "I don't know what she's talking about, but we need to get out of here right now. I'm sure we will be fine if we could just get past the borders of this town, at least. I think so. And I also think some sort of biological outbreak is causing people to go insane." As if on cue, a car sped past, fire leaping out of the shattered windows. I smelled burning rubber, hot metal, and roasting meat. A disgusting combination of aromas that the nightmarish scene left in its wake. The driver hit a tree, flying through the windshield and smashing his burned body into the trunk at an incredible speed. I saw by the awkward angle of his neck that he was either dead or dying. He looked like a bird who had flown into a window, the neck snapped and the head lolling weakly at a 45-degree angle on a totally broken spine. I turned to look at him sharply. "Where's your mother?" "In the house," he said. I took the keys out of the ignition, grabbing Anthony's small hand and running towards our home of 10 years. I kept looking left and right for the corpse girl, but she hadn't reappeared yet. I wondered if Anthony truly was so powerful that he could scare her away for good. I seriously doubted it. I had a feeling she was biding her time, and probably watching us at this very moment. The thought sent chills down my spine. As I walked into the entryway, I started yelling her name, trying to get out of here as soon as possible. "Margaret!" I screamed. Anthony was next to me screaming, "Mom, where are you?" I led him to the kitchen first, where I grabbed a butcher's knife and gave Anthony a small but very still sharp knife from the kitchen drawer. "Don't stab yourself by accident with that, kiddo," I said. "Only use it as a last resort." He nodded. "I wish I had guns here, but we..." At that moment, my words were cut off by a wailing, pain-filled shrieking from upstairs. Unwilling to be separated from him for any reason now, and kicked open the master bedroom door. There, I saw our priest, Father Lanigan, with a pistol to my wife's head. He was very clearly sick, bleeding from his eyes and nose, a waterfall of gore spilling out of his heaving, gasping mouth. I put my hands up. "Father Lanigan," I said loudly and simply. "Put down the gun. You're sick." He just breathed louder and faster, his gray eyes beginning to film over with milky, blood-smeared cataracts. He reminded me more and more of the corpse girl. Even his stare was similar. An almost reptilian, sadistic glower that looked down onto everything and everyone around. I took a step forward. All of his attention was focused on me. His gun hand shook hard. "Look, Father, you aren't like this," I said. "You can..." But I never got to finish my sentence. At that moment, my son, small and brave, ran through the alternative door to the master bedroom, his small knife raised above his head like a tiny Amazonian warrior. "Let go of my mommy," Anthony said, plunging the knife into Father Lanigan's stomach. The priest howled in pain and I ran forward, grabbing his gun hand just as he was aiming it at my son. I pushed it up with all my strength, and the shot went high, blowing apart a dresser drawer. I took the knife and shoved it directly through his right eye. His other eye widened in surprise, the bloody tear coming faster for a moment. Then he slumped to the floor. My heart racing, I grabbed the gun out of his hand, making sure it wasn't pointed at my son or wife in case he had the strength to pull the trigger one last time. And as it turns out, he did. The last shot went through the window. The tinkling of glass mixing with the ringing in my ears from the gunshots at such a close distance. And then I had the revolver out of his hand, putting it in my back pocket sign. "Let's get out of this madhouse of a town," I said to my wife. She just cried and hugged me, putting her face against my shoulder for a few moments. Then we ran outside, grabbing some bottled water and canned foods on the way and throwing them in a plastic bag. I drove out of there as fast as I could, quickly entering the fields and woods at the edge of town. But just as I was about to cross over into the next town, I found that the road was blocked. Dozens of bodies were stacked one on top of another, across the road and the sides of the road. There was no possible way around them. Half of them were naked or wearing torn rags, and some of them still twitching and moaning. They were all crying blood, vomiting gore that ran down the group. I pulled over, putting my head against the steering wheel and crying. I tried calling for help, but the phone calls wouldn't connect. The internet still worked, so I wrote up what was happening. In case my family and I don't make it out of here, I wanted someone to know what really happened in my town. Sighing in frustration and despair, grabbing the revolver and handing the butcher's knife to my wife, we all got out of the car and started walking. Part 2. As we walked past the pile of corpses stacked like cordwood in a pile 20 feet high, the wind seemed to pick up. The smell of feces, urine, rot, and rancid sweat emanated from the pile of bodies, nearly making me throw up. My son Anthony and my wife Margaret both tried to hide their faces in the crook of their elbows, their skin looking pale and all too white. I heard my little boy suppress a small wretch, bending over as the smell grew stronger for a few moments. When we were walking away, and though it was still terrible, the smell started to fade after a few hundred feet. I had driven on this road out of town hundreds of times in my life, and yet I realized I didn't recognize my surroundings. Furrowing my brow, I looked around. The pavement in front of us had turned white. I saw tiny bones placed closely together forming the streets. The trees had also changed. They looked like weeping willows, but instead of long strands of leaves hanging down, they had what looked like intestines and long strands of bloody hair blowing softly in the breeze, moving from side to side. As we drew closer, I realized thousands and thousands of maggots and other larvae swarmed on their otherworldly branches. The concerted motion of so many insects gave them a shimmering, vibrating quality. There was a sound like high-pitched crying that came out of the forests. And as I looked closer, I realized these sounds were coming from the trees themselves. "Where are we?" my wife asked, her eyes wide, her body trembling. My heart beat so fast, I could no longer differentiate the separate beats. They all slammed together in a concerted frenzy as I realized we had walked away from our world and into the world of the monstrous corpse girl and her insane god that my son had told me about.
"She told me they call it Golgotha," my son whispered. "The place of the skulls."
"But how did we get here?" I asked. "And more importantly, how do we get out? Can we just turn around?" I looked back down the road and realized the pile of corpses that had marked the entrance to this mad world was now gone. I saw only white streets paved with bones stretching off in the horizon, endless forests of willows with blood and intestines hanging from them lining each side. Nearby, I heard the gurgling of a stream.
"No,"
my son said softly.
"We are in here, and I could feel her presence. The dead girl. She watches us right now. She's trying to get in my..."
He pointed at his head.
"We have to go on ahead. I could keep her out, though. She won't be able to get inside any of you if you're near me. I know how to fight her. She could try to reach inside me, or me inside her."
My wife grabbed my free hand tightly. I prayed to God that Anthony was right, that I wouldn't end slashing myself open to let unknown viruses in, or be forced to kill my family by telepathic control, or something else that was hard to imagine, but had become only too real today.
"I'm scared,"
she whispered to me, too quietly for my son to hear. I nodded to her grimly, opening the revolver and checking the bullets. I had only 4 left, and I didn't even know if bullets would harm this thing in this place. Then we heard a voice that seemed to boom from the sky. It was deep, shaking the ground. Pieces of intestines and blood fell from the trees around us, and the streets of bones shook, some of them falling out of place like pure white potholes. I grabbed my wife, steadying her as we almost toppled over. My son seemed almost unaffected, but his eyes were wide and he was looking straight up. I looked up also, seeing the sky had begun to rapidly turn from blue to black as if an eclipse were happening. But I could see no sun, no source of light, no moon or stars. Instead, I only saw a face begin to emerge from the darkness. It was a face that seemed to stretch hundreds of miles across. Its skeletal cheekbones and bleached white forehead seemed to blend into the blackness of the sky. Its chattering jawbone and massive pointed teeth opened and closed quickly in an eerie, shuffling way that didn't match at all its words. It reminded me of a wind-up toy I had as a kid. One that would just have teeth that would chatter and bounce off each other as the toy moved forward in a random way. But its eyes were its most disconcerting feature. They were pure silver, but in that silver there was a rapid shimmering and rotating. Madness emanated from every part of its face, and I felt it look deep into my mind. It had a presence that was not only insane, but insectal, antithetical to life, and worst of all, eternal.
"Have you brought me a new lamb for the slaughter?" it said, in a voice like rushing water. "Give me the boy. He will have company with the dead ones, the other boys and girls here. They're all dead, but nothing here ever really dies. Give me your child and I will let you go."
Then it stopped speaking, the only movement in the whole sky being its eyes, which were now revolving faster, deeper and lighter shades of silver appearing and disappearing in a rapidly moving fractal pattern that seemed to zoom forever inwards towards the center. "No," I said simply, my heart beating fast, but a rising sense of anger battling it and giving me new strength. I put my middle finger and aimed it at the sky. The voice laughed louder than ever. I heard trees falling in the woods surrounding us, the stream no longer gurgling but being thrown around like tidal waves on the banks of its shore.
"Then you will all die," it said, its voice fading as if zooming away from us.
Then the face and the blackness were gone, the sky returning to a deep blue. Light seemed to return to the world, and the eerie insectal fingers that grabbed and felt around my mind disappeared in an instant. On the horizon above the trees, I realized I could see thick, dark clouds of smoke rising above the tree line. The road seemed to head in that general direction. Motioning with my hand, I turned to my family. "It looks like there could be some sort of town or factory over there," I said. "If we keep going on this road, it will probably bring us close. Or we could turn around and walk back in the opposite direction. What do you two think?" My questions were broken by a sob from the nearby trees. Whirling around, I saw Trooper Shay, his dress uniform torn, cuts and scrapes all over his body. His mouth turned into a perfect O of surprise, his eyes widening as he looked at us.
"Please," he said, "help me."
Then he fell over like a rag doll, plummeting into the dry soil and dead grass that surrounded the skeletal road. My wife began to run over to him, but I put a hand on her shoulder, stopping her.
"He could be infected," I said. She glared at me.
"So you're going to just let him die?" she asked. I shook my head. "We approach danger slowly," I said. "We only have one revolver with a few shots, one butcher's knife, and one small knife that we gave Anthony, which is basically a paring knife." I laughed, even though it wasn't funny. The sound of laughter in this grim place sounded wrong, and I quickly stopped. Margaret just gave me one more disapproving frown, then pushed my hand away and knelt beside the Trooper Shay. She had some medical background, having been a certified nursing assistant in her early 20s, and used it to check him over briefly. She checked his pulse, his breathing, opened one eye and then the other to check the responsiveness of his pupils, and making sure no blood was coming out either. Turning back to me, she nodded. "He doesn't seem sick like the others," she said. "He was laying on his back, and she flipped him over to check for injuries on that side. As soon as she did, we all saw the cause of his collapse. He was bleeding rather heavily. It looked like someone had stuck a knife into the back of his left shoulder, then pulled it out again. The blood was clotting, staining his trooper uniform a dirty red color on his back. He had clearly lost a great deal of blood. "I don't think it hit an artery," my wife said to me. My son stood behind me, holding my free hand while I kept the revolver ready, scanning the forest and road for any sign of movement. At that point, Trooper Shay began to moan, his eyes fluttering open.
"Do you?"
he said, licking his lips and clearing his voice.
"Water?"
"Well, there is a stream nearby," I said, getting up. "I don't know if it is drinkable, however. For all I know, the streams here could be made of pure mercury." He shook his head.
"They're water,"
Shay said, coming back more and more to consciousness as he spoke. "I drank some of it when I was running. It tasted fine." He got up slowly, and my wife came running over. He put an arm around her, looking like he might fall over again, but after a few breaths, he steadied himself.
"Something was chasing me. I don't know how I got here. One minute, I was in the fields, running towards the woods, and then suddenly the trees all changed and the sky went black. One of those nut jobs in the middle of town just stabbed me in the back. My partner ended up getting bitten, and he became so sick within minutes that I knew there was no way I was getting him out of here. He went down fighting, though. He took out 5 or 6 of the sick people with him before they all jumped on him and began ripping his body apart with their teeth, their fingernails, everything. It was like a savage dog attack." We started walking towards the sound of the gurgling stream nearby. As soon as we reached the shallow bank, Trooper Shay fell to his knees, cupping his palms and drinking as much water as he could handle. He then splashed it on his face and stood up.
"All right, let's get out of this frickin' place," he said, pulling out his service pistol and putting a fresh magazine in.
We returned to the road and began to walk towards the smoke in the city. Within minutes, the forest started to clear out, and I saw towering buildings on the horizon drawing closer. It was eerie how quiet they were, however. I didn't hear a single car or bus coming from that direction. Soon, the forest and the hanging intestines and gore were behind us, and we stood in a post-apocalyptic nightmare. Buildings hundreds of stories tall stood all around us, many with their windows smashed out. Bodies with nooses around their necks hung from lampposts on both sides of the road. Many had been there for so long that the skin and muscles were sloughing off, rancid gas causing them to bloat, their faces unrecognizable, their clothes bowing out from the pressure of the decomposition.
"The girl is coming," my son said, pointing down the road.
We all had our weapons at the ready. It would have seemed absurd in other circumstances, being so afraid of a little girl no more than 4 feet tall. Her mouth, stitched closed, had dark blood dripping down from her lips, and her eyes were wide, sparkling, almost smiling. Her deadly white skin showed black, rotting veins that were throughout her body, hidden by black rags she wore in many spots. Then I heard her voice in my mind as she came to a stop.
"The god of Golgotha welcomes you all," she said.
I could tell by the widening eyes of the others that they all heard her voice as well.
"This is your last chance. A sacrifice is required to move forward. Give us the boy. We will take good care of him for you. He will never die. Nothing here ever really dies."
At this, Trooper Shay raised the pistol and fired a shot at her. It hit her in the dead center of her chest, knocking her back. The voice stopped instantly.
"Run!" my son said. "There's more coming from behind us."
Glancing back, I saw he was right. Dozens of boys and girls were coming out of the abandoned skyscrapers, flooding the bone-white roads, all with their mouths stitched closed. Some wore decaying suits or the rags of dresses, while others looked much fresher, with intact shirts or pants still on their tiny bodies. Seeing that, we all sprinted away. We stayed behind my son, knowing he would be the slowest of us all. The others rapidly gained on us, and I felt tiny hands grasping at the back of my shirt, trying to pull me back. Turning quickly, I fired a bullet into the nearest target. A small boy with a suit that looked like it would have been new during World War II. The back of his head exploded as I fired point blank into his forehead. The reaction of the others chasing us was immediate. They all stopped, their eyes widening as they saw the dark clotted blood and brain matter that sprayed the street behind the corpse child. They all placed their hands on the gore, trying to shove it through the stitches in their mouths. I heard deep slurping sounds as they sucked the blood through the black stitching, pulling their lips apart so hard that fresh blood began to pour out of the stitches. Incision sites as they tried to feast, taking in as much as they could. It gave us just the distraction we needed. While they circled around the dead boy, eating his body like vultures surrounding a piece of roadkill, we got farther and farther away. Trooper Shea running in the lead, my wife behind him, then my son and me. We took random turns, going down long abandoned alleyways and moving deeper into the center of the city. Soon, we heard nothing at all besides the heavy footfalls of our group. "Stop," I said, gasping, bent over next to a dumpster filled with shoes in a tiny alleyway between two skyscrapers. "I need the rest." My son clearly did too. He was breathing hard, doubled over. Trooper Shea and Margaret turned to look at us.
"What now?"
Margaret asked. I looked down at my son. "Do you have any idea how to get out of here?" I asked. Surprisingly, he nodded. "I got a glimpse from the girl's mind when she was talking to us," Anthony said. "But I think she saw some stuff in mine, too. I don't know if it matters or not." I shrugged. "Nothing we could do about that now," I said. "So, how do we get out of here?" "There is a well at the center of the city," Anthony said. "Where they go when they need fresh boys and girls to follow the god here, or when they need bodies to feed them."
"So let's go," Trooper Shea said, pushing my son in front of him. "Lead the way, kid. We got your back. Let's get the hell out of this place."
Nodding, Anthony started walking on shaky legs. We followed him out of the alleyway to a massive street 6 lanes wide.
"It should be down this way," Anthony said,
pointing deeper into the tangle of abandoned buildings. I saw a cloud of black smoke where his finger pointed. There we heard the voice of the insane god again, but not coming from the sky this time. It was on the street and not far away. The ground started to shake. Turning to look in the opposite direction that my son had pointed, I saw a behemoth dozens of feet tall. It had the same skeletal face, the same chattering jawbone and sharpened teeth, but it now stood on a slender, naked body with pus and deep gouge marks marring nearly every inch of its skin. "Thank you for delivering the lamb to me personally," it said in that voice so much like the waterfall, each syllable pounding into the other and causing small earthquakes as it spoke. There was no way we could outrun it. Though its legs and arms were sticks with bones showing through its countless injuries, it was fast and very tall. My wife looked back at me one last time.
"Get him out of here,"
she whispered to me, pointing to Anthony.
"No matter what it takes."
Then she ran directly at the insane god. Its head swiveled rapidly. Its silver eyes followed her progress with a kind of lunatic intensity, its long arms reaching out to grab her, but she ducked into a nearby alleyway. The thing followed her, howling.
Run, you idiots!
Trooper Shay said. I wanted to go help her, but I knew he was right. She had likely given her life to save our son, but to do anything else but get us out would be a waste of her sacrifice. With tears pouring down my cheeks, I pushed my son ahead.
Go, Anthony!
I screamed. Looking back at me, bewildered, he looked like he would just stand there forever.
But what about Mommy?
He cried.
Just go!
Then we all started to run. The black cloud of smoke was growing rapidly nearer when I heard the shrieks of a woman. I knew it was Margaret. It sounded like she was being burnt alive. A kind of pain and horror I had never heard in any voice before, even as a 911 dispatcher. I could see the well Anthony was talking about now, only a few hundred feet away. Black clouds of smoke emanated from it, blocking out the sky above. It seemed as if there was some eternal fire burning within it. Then the children began to crawl and run out from every street and alleyway surrounding the well, forming a rough circle around it. They all stopped and stared at us with their dead eyes.
I have an idea, Trooper Shay said, looking at me with shell-shocked eyes. But you're not going to like it.
Then he ran forward, nearly emptying his magazine with a rapid succession of shots, aiming at the monstrous bodies that surrounded him. With the first 9 shots, he blew some of them apart, leaving huge exit wounds in their chests and heads as he fired rapidly. When they closed all around him and I knew he was out of time and nearly out of ammo, glancing back at me one last time, his eyes watery and terrified, he put the gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. I saw it in slow motion.
No!
I screamed. But it was too late. The entire back of his head exploded like a deflated balloon. The corpse children swarmed all around his body, dipping their small white hands in his blood and brain matter, trying to shove as much as they could into their stitched mouths. Without a moment of hesitation, I lifted Anthony and ran forward, jumping into the well, the clouds of black smoke enveloping us as we fell. I woke up at the border of the town, surrounded by people in hazmat suits. I saw countless agents and unmarked black SUVs blocking off the border of the town. One man in a hazmat suit came over, shining a light into my eyes. I saw another doing the same to Anthony next to me. Then I fell back into unconsciousness. I awoke later in a medical facility, surrounded by a few agents in black suits. They wouldn't tell me which agency they came from, but told me my entire town had an outbreak of a mutated form of rabies. I shook my head. There was a dead girl with her mouth stitched closed, I said, and they laughed. A few of the other survivors said the same thing, one of them said. Likely mass hysteria. Maybe a group hallucination from stress of seeing such a horrifying outbreak. We have the entire town quarantined, however. So far, we have been able to keep this out of the media, and the goal is to continue to do that. We don't need you to go around talking about monsters. I stopped listening after that, knowing that they would never believe me. They never mentioned how many of the bodies were never found, including those of my wife and Trooper Shay. Both of them sacrificed themselves to save our lives. Nor how a mutated form of rabies could stack hundreds of bodies into piles like cordwood, blocking off many of the roads into and out of town. Since then, Anthony and I had moved far away from that town, the one that killed my wife and all my friends. I thought that I'd left the terror behind and started to heal. Then, last night, as I fell asleep, I had a dream of an insane god with chattering teeth and silver eyes, telling me he would see me again soon. When I woke, my floor was covered in footprints that left behind dark, clotted blood leading towards my bed.